For information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a morning news and public affairs director, as well as an evening news and public affairs director to manage the news and public affairs programming. For these two full-time positions, we're looking for people with proven experience in audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tesla City Stories on Friday, June 28th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tesla City Stories is a live recreation of the Golden Age of Radio performed monthly in downtown Portland. These all-ages shows feature comedy, mysteries, romance, and more, with live Foley sound effects, music, prizes, and audience participation. Again, that's Tesla City Stories on Friday, June 28th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m. and time for the radio zine. I was reminding y'all earlier about what it takes to keep community radio going, and that's the involvement of the community, especially with pennies, nickels, and dimes. Some members of your community get involved in a particular, shall we say, a specific subset of financial support for community radio, one of which I am pleased, honored, and contractually obligated to remind you about right now, that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Featuring farm direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmers market every Wednesday year round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop. And now, as promised, this is the Radio Zine.
Good morning. You're tuned into Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Jenna Yokoyama, and today we're going to be looking at the recent news around the detainment and mistreatment of migrant children. With me on the phone this morning from France is Professor Carina Moreno, Associate Professor at Hunter College in the Department of Urban Studies at City University in New York. She is a native of Monterrey, Nuevo León, Mexico, and is the author of Jacobin magazine articles such as The Private Deportation Machine, as well as the article Political Theater at the Border. Welcome to Radio Zine, and thank you for joining us this morning, Professor Moreno.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be speaking with you.
Well, first off, I'd like to start by taking a look at the most recent news that we've heard that has come out of Clint, Texas, where the Border Detention Center that was cited recently as having major health and sanitation concerns for the children that were detained there, and they were removed. But as of Tuesday, there was news that actually 100 children have been brought back to the detention center because of overcrowding at other centers. I'm just wondering, as someone who has been studying this and has been following this for many years now, what was your reaction to hearing about the detention facility at Clint?
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, my reaction is Well, of course, hindsight is everything, right? But one of the last things that the Obama administration did was a closed bid deal with Corrections Corporation of America, which is now called CoreCivic, the private prison company, a closed bid of $1 billion for family detention. So my reaction to all of this is, of course, these conditions are absolutely horrifying. This is a very long-term traumatic problem that the U.S. is going to be dealing with in many different ways. But when I think about that was one of the last things that the Obama administration did, there was a couple of hints. There were clues that we could see that family detention in particular was going to expand and was going to grow, regardless, you know, had it been the Trump administration or had it been the Clinton administration, if Hillary Clinton had been elected. The problem is that the Trump administration is really completely define the judicial standards that have been laid out in court about how long you can detain children. They have instituted complete new measures that we hadn't seen before. Last summer we had the big issue of family separation, where families were being separated and detained separately, privately. That's still going on. And we see more and more just blatant disregard for the lives of migrants, especially children. Last week in court, the Trump administration was arguing that they should not be expected to provide mattresses, blankets, doctors, soap, toothbrushes, beds to any of the migrant children. So this is an administration that has no moral conundrum over their actions.
So you mentioned how the Obama administration, was the ones who granted this $1 billion contract with CCA, who you had mentioned what they're going by now as CoreCivics, was that correct?
CoreCivic, yes.
So if we could just kind of back up a little bit and talk about why was it that CCA at the time when they were being called CCA, why were they brought in by the Obama administration in the first place?
So this is, you know, this was a $1 billion deal. I mention it because it was the largest closed bid deal that had been granted up to that point. So I mention it because it stands out, or it's peculiar in that way. Except the U.S. has multiple family detention centers, and they started expanding family detention centers under the Obama administration because I don't know if you remember we had the flow of unaccompanied minors when Obama was president that were coming to the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum. And that's why the federal government at that point started expanding family detention centers. It's not a practice that started under the Trump administration. I would like to point that out because there are lots of misconceptions going around and misinformation going around. So this is not a new practice. Families, you know, we talked a little bit previously about the Flores Agreement. Families have been coming to the U.S.-Mexico border to ask for asylum for years, for decades. So it's not unusual, it's not new to put families in detention while they are coming to the border to request and seek asylum. The problem is, what we are seeing under Trump that is new is the family separation issues and the conditions we're getting. The conditions were never, by no means were they, glamorous or okay. But now we see that there is a complete blatant disregard of very basic functions of being, you know, access to doctors, access to bathrooms, access to a mattress to sleep on. There's nothing of that. Five children have died in Texas in the last 6 months over a common cold because no one let them see a doctor in those facilities. So that's what we are seeing that is new. It's just a complete and utter maltreatment and abuse in these centers. but it's not a new practice. And we can talk about the judicial regulations that are in place. What the Supreme Court decided in the early 90s with the Flores Agreement was that you can hold minors in detention, but there was a time limit of 72 hours, number one, and the judicial decision says that it has to be the least restrictive setting to have to hold a child. So basically, these family detention centers are different. They have to have different licensing than the adult detention centers. They're supposed to have licensing that's very similar in regulation to a child care facility. So somewhere you would, you know, drop off your kid to, you know, while you go to work. The family detention centers should have licensing that's very similar to that in terms of health codes, inspection codes, safety codes, all of that. The decision says the setting has to be appropriate for children. It has to, it's supposed to prioritize. This is a very big difference between, again, the Obama administration and the Trump administration. The detaining of children, it's supposed to prioritize family reunification. So you're supposed to prioritize, you know, you're holding the child momentarily with the goal of reunifying them with their families. So this is, again, something that is not being, it's not what's actually happening. It's not what we're seeing. And we have just seen a rather unusual number of very, very young children. So last week, I think very recently, the New York Times reported that the youngest child to have been detained by the Trump administration is a four-month-old. So we, you know, this is something that we hadn't, I hadn't come across. A lot of children under the age of three, a lot of little disease outbreaks because they're overcrowded. So, you know, fevers go around, one of them gets sick and then all of them get sick. So there have been a few reports that, you know, there are lots of sickness with fever, diarrhea, things like this over just because of the conditions alone that they're in.
So you mentioned the Flores Agreement, which to my understanding was happened in the late 90s. If this agreement isn't being held to right now, is there any sort of other political will that people can bring forward to try to bring better protections for not just the children, but everybody who's being detained and is being mistreated or is not being addressed to the full extent of their humanity?
That's a great question. So first, I just want to point out it's a 1993 Supreme Court decision. So this issue is going to be something that's going to be argued in court, and it's going to be challenged. It is being challenged in court by several immigration lawyer advocacy groups already. But essentially what the Flores Agreement, you know, outlines is due process. This is how you respect due process of people who are seeking asylum, who are at the border, you know, trying to escape persecution, violence in their home countries. So this is an issue about due process. I would recommend there are a number of advocacy groups that are really working hard on this issue in regards to legal representation. So one of the main issues when it comes to immigration detention centers, it functions essentially the same as the criminal justice system in the U.S. So immigrant detention centers operate out of county jails or private prisons, essentially just the same as being in normal jail, even though immigration matters are not criminal matters, they're civil disputes. But I bring this up because the one difference between these two systems is that in the criminal justice system in the U.S., if you don't have the money for an attorney, you have a public defender that is appointed for you, right? That's part of the law. That's one of the protections that the law affords everyone that, you know, is trying to grant equal protections. In the immigration system, there's no such protection. There's no such thing. So you don't have access to an attorney. You don't have access to any sort of legal representation. Many times, and this is a very, you know, gray area, where this is where we say this is a violation of due process, because you, what is happening is you have a large group of immigrants. Many of them are, because the system is being overcrowded, they are brought before an immigration judge in groups, and they all, you know, are, they don't understand what's going on. Some of them don't speak English. There are no translators. They don't have the they should be asking for an attorney or a translator, but they don't. And they end up, you know, making a claim, making a plea in front of the judge that they don't even understand the implications of. So there, for example, there is a nonprofit, Raices, that's R-A-I-C-E-S, and they work really hard with sort of on the ground, frontline movement with sending immigration attorneys to help, you know, represent people who are caught in these circumstances. And that makes a huge difference in the outcome. If you have an attorney to assist you and represent you, then the chances of you getting out of the detention center, the chances of you understanding what the process is like, being reunited with your family, being able to find your family, just increase exponentially versus if you're in there without any access to legal aid. So that's something that people can do by all means, and you know, these organizations are building coalitions to fight this in court as well, because the Flores Agreement is in place for a reason, and you know, the, we are seeing blatant violations where children are not supposed to be held for more than 72 hours, and right now the Trump administration is holding children for up to 3 weeks. And mind you, I want to mention that the amount of time matters, first of all, not just for the health of the children, but it matters as well, because every night that there is someone in custody, someone in detention, there are dollars to be made, because Homeland Security is funding all of this with tax dollars, with our tax dollars.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Radio Zine here on Cable Community Radio. My guest this morning is Professor Karina Moreno, and we're discussing the crisis around the treatment of migrant children here in the United States. And just to touch on exactly what you were just talking about, is the question is constantly, who is profiting off this? And so could you talk more a little bit about that, about who is profiting?
Sure. So Homeland Security, in the name, you know, in the U.S., there are so many things that get pushed through very easily without any pushback from the people, without any pushback from the legislature, without any pushback from a lot of, you know, no one seems to rather notice. Until now, it seems to be that we're at a point in time where people are starting to question these things and starting to pull back. But, you know, in the last couple decades, especially since 9/11, the U.S. has been able to get by with a lot of things in the name of national security. And one of those things that I really want to emphasize is the privatization, the outsourcing of contracts by Homeland Security. So Homeland Security went from enforcing immigration on its own and outsourcing about 3% of its work in fiscal year 2005, something like this. So it was just, you know, it was managing itself, its own work. Right now, Homeland Security outsources, privatizes about 90% of its work. A lot of it, so detention is primarily run by private contractors. And that is, when we talk specifically about detention, it's two main companies. It's the same as the war on drugs. We see it now with the war on terror. It's the same forces at play. It's mainly two private prison companies. One of them is CoreCivic, which used to be Corrections Corporation of America, and the other one is the GEO Group. And they run about 70% of the detention industry. I want to really emphasize that this is a billion-dollar mechanism. Deportation, detention, is costing American tax dollars, American taxpayers, about $2 billion a year, because that's how much Homeland Security is granting these companies to run detention for them. So there is a lot of money to be made. These companies both lobby Department of Homeland Security directly and spend millions of dollars in donations, in efforts to halt immigration reform. It's in their best interest that we don't have a huge immigration reform overhaul, because that would mean that their business is at stake. And it's very profitable. So right now we have about 100 detention centers in about 30 states in the U.S. Again, they're not criminal proceedings, they're administrative proceedings, yet they operate out of the exact same facilities. And the problem when you have private contractors involved is that you have no legal right to ask for data. Transparency laws that apply to a government institution don't apply to private contractors. So information that would be public, were immigrants being held in public facilities, it would be a different process trying to get information. They would have to abide to transparency laws, and that doesn't apply to private contractors. And I also want to mention that there was a Jennings versus Rodriguez decision in the Supreme Court, which decided that when it comes to adults being held in immigrant detention centers, there is no time limit. There is no time restraint. There's no maximum amount of time that an immigrant can be held. And so I'm really glad you brought up what can we do, not just for the children, but people who are being held here. There was a study done by Syracuse University. They found that the people that were being held in detention centers the longest in the U.S. were actually legal residents. You know, so there's so much misconception and so much misinformation going around. And regardless of, you know, these terms that the Trump administration keeps throwing out at us, keeps throwing out illegal immigrants, illegal aliens, these terms are meant to dehumanize, you know, that these are actually real human people who have committed no crime, and it is their legal right to ask for asylum in the United States. But, you know, the what we see that's happening with the Trump administration is they're just trying to use their rhetoric to placate people and to say, you know, somehow, yes, it's okay, or it's what they deserve, or things like this. We need to be really careful.
You know, a little bit early, you mentioned what people can do. I know that it's possibly, you know, individuals, it feels like an overwhelming situation. I can't even imagine what it's like for the people who are stuck in it. But for our listeners who would like to take some kind of action or some sort of step to help support the people who are currently detained, what steps can they take as individuals to do that?
I would really recommend the Raices organization. Every single dollar that you donate goes to legal representation. Right now, immigrants in detention centers, only about 10% of them have access to legal representation. That 10% having access to a lawyer makes a huge difference in the outcome of how long they're detained, when they can see their families, and so forth. So I know it's a sort of cliche, you know, to say you can donate, but if you donate to this organization, I can guarantee that presentation to help people. So it'll go to secure that. The other thing that you can do, depending on your location, there are some groups locally where they need help with translators. So sometimes these people who are going before an immigration judge, they speak very, very limited English. They don't know what's going on. They don't understand the process. So there are lots of volunteer groups that can help place you according to your skills, according to what you want to do, according to, you know, whatever you feel comfortable with. But there are local groups out there, and I can look a little bit further into Portland if you want, and send you an email with some contact information so that your listeners, if they want to get involved, they can.
Yes, that would be great. We'll make sure to put it on our website on today's episode page for anybody who's interested in seeing those links.
Sure. So I will get that over to you because it's really important. I think there is momentum. I think there is, you know, this issue being in the spotlight, it gives us an opportunity to do something, but we have to do something fast because the longer that this drags out, the less we become, it will become normalized. We won't react to it anymore. We this will somehow desensitize us as consumers of, you know, just this information that's been, yes, you know, it's been repeated. We keep seeing it. It's horrifying. But, you know, we did the same thing last year with family separation policies. You know, there was a reaction, and that seemed to really affect the Trump administration. They had a lot of turmoil after that. They had to replace the Homeland Security secretary. You know, there was a backlash, and that did affect them. So I think there is I think it is necessary to hang on to this momentum and to make clear that we are not okay with number one, due process being violated. We are all guaranteed the legal right to due process, and number two, that we're not okay with these horrible conditions of abuse and neglect, whether they be adults or children.
You know, we're almost out of time this morning for Radio Zine. I just want to quickly remind our listeners that if you missed any part of this interview, you can find the entire interview wherever you download your podcast or on our website at kbu.fm, where you can also find those links to Professor Moreno's articles as well as the resources that she brings forward to us that I will put on at the end of our show. Professor, before we go, and I wanted to just thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us today. What is it that you would like our listeners to remember? What is one of the most important things you'd like our listeners to remember from this interview in terms of addressing this humanitarian crisis?
The one thing that I would like for us to remember is that while we are speaking about children not having access to mattresses, blankets, doctors, soap, toothbrushes, the Trump administration is arguing against their obligation to have to give toothbrushes and soap to these children. While we're arguing about this, these two private prison companies are going to make record amounts of it these quarters because they're being paid by with tax dollars by Homeland Security. Homeland Security is outsourcing, is privatizing, and this is something that we never talk about. So while we go on about these moral conflicts, it's even a greater evil that there is profit being made in the background that we never speak about, that we don't see, that is being held very, very carefully so by those in power behind the scenes. But these facilities are private facilities. This is capitalism, of course, embedded in all of this process. So there is a political ploy at stake, of course. You know, immigration has always been a very political topic, but there's also a very capitalistic mechanism behind it that keeps pushing out these images and this rhetoric, and is going to try to distract us from the fact that there is profit being made, that there is that there are companies who are being tasked with the treatment, the detainment, the holding of these families, of these children, and that these facilities are making a record amount of money off of this abuse. So I would really want for us to keep that at the center of the conversation instead of going back and forth on semantics, on, you know, illegal immigration. This is not illegal immigration. These are people who are going to the U.S. border in an effort to petition for asylum. Everyone's legal right to petition for asylum, that's afforded to everyone in the Constitution. If you are fearing persecution and violence in your home country, this is your legal right. And we just keep seeing all these political ploys and all these political tactics by the Trump administration being thrown at us, trying to distract us from the key issues. That one, this is not an issue of illegal immigration. Even if it was, there is no excuse for humanizing people and not treating people with basic level of respect and dignity. And two, that the issue that there are private contractors behind the scenes that are making a whole lot of money and are, you know, the longer we carry this out, the happier they are.
We're all out of time for this morning, but I do want to thank you again, Professor Karina Moreno, the Associate Professor at Hunter College, Department of
Thanks
Urban
so
Studies
much.
At City University of New York. We appreciate you taking the time and for sharing your resources.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate everyone who tunes into your show.
And you're still tuned to KBOO Portland. We're going to continue the Radio Zine block with Web of Life. Let's check it out. It's 11:30.
Today on Wings.
Realigning with the value of life, Indigenous perspectives. The difference is that nothing that was required for the sustaining of life was ever made a commodity.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In April 2015, Angela Miles of the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education hosted an evening of 10 women speaking on themes of gift, matriarchy, mothering, and Indigenous worldviews. Here is Sherry Mitchell's talk, introduced by Angela Miles.
Sherry was born and raised in the Penobscot Indian Reservation. She speaks and teaches around the world on Indigenous worldview and spiritual change. Sherry is the author of Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change. She's the founding director of the Land Peace Foundation, an organization dedicated to the global protection of Indigenous land and water rights and the Indigenous way of life. Sherry is also the visionary behind Healing the Wounds of Turtle Island, a global healing ceremony that has brought people together from all corners of the world, and very, very, very centrally points out the spiritual and the economic here. These things are inseparable. They've been separated and torn apart in a lying way in our society. They have to come together, and I think the kind of work that Sherry does that in a really exemplary way.
Kwe, Andeliwisi, Wanahamugwasit, Najiopunawipskik, Pasilda, Ndeldambayamakawasus, Nilpunawipskik, Nagakakagus, Niltibayik, Nalita Haziu, and Dayan. My name is Wanahamugwasit, and the colonial name that I was given by requirement at birth was Sherry Mitchell, and I'm happy to be able to be here with you. I decided that I would talk about the things that are most important to me in regard to these issues that we're facing in regard to mothering and a new way of placing value in the world. Because I think that the problem with the market exchange is that we have placed all of our value on a market economy. We even define people who are single as being on the market. So even our most personal relationships are based in this kind of valuation system. And one of the problems is the fragmentation and commodification of ourselves. As women, we were the first commodity in this trade market. 3000 BCE, women were sold and traded for the purposes of marriage. And so our bodies became the first product. That led to slavery, that led to the valuation of individual property rights, the taking of the land. All of these other things kind of spiraled out of that initial commodification of the body of the woman. And so we see the suppression of women's rights being in direct correlation to the desecration of Mother Earth. And so when we think about who we are where we come from, where we belong. All of those things have to be evaluated in our discussions about these things, because it's critically important for us to have an understanding of where we've come from, how we got there, and where we need to go from here going forward, because mistakes are repeated when we're not aware of how they were created. And so I want to just tell you some stories. I want to tell you about one of our creation stories. In our tradition, I can only speak for my own tradition, which is a unique perspective. And it is not an indigenous perspective per se, in the way that there's a pan-indigenous worldview, though there are similarities. We all have distinct cultural beliefs. We all have distinct traditions. We all have distinct ways of being in relation to life, but there are core similarities that can be found across the globe in indigenous cultures. And I also, at some point, want to address the question about pride that this young woman over here, and I can say she's a young woman because I'm older than she is, about having pride in who we are as indigenous people. For me, like, who am I as a Skijinawe Apid, Nelbunwapskek? Who am I as a daughter of the Penobscot Nation? And so in our creation stories, there are two figures that make up the creator. The creator is not a single individual. And we look at the world from a balanced point of view. So we have Kichiniwesk and Ekjimundo. Kichiniwesk is a sacred feminine. Ekjimundo is the sacred masculine. And in this story, Ekjimundo is the void of all possibility. It's that collection of matter that's waiting for animation. And so Ekjimundo sits stable, waiting for the voice of Kichiniwesk to speak into him. And it is the voice of the sacred feminine speaking into that pool of matter that provides us with all possibilities, creating ripples, vibrations that create form. And then that form is animated and moves out into the world. And that's the dance between the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. And so in our stories, when we talk about our creation and how that connects to our web of life, we don't have 3 months to sit here together and talk about all of the stories. But what I can tell you is that seed of life created through the dance of Kichiniwesk and Ekjimundo, when it was put into motion and that seed expanded, creating all life across our universe, that creates what we know as the web of life. And this web of life concept is not theoretical, it's not mythological, it's scientific. We all come from this great seed of life that exploded and expanded across the known universe. And so our teachings about web of life, what we call Pasilda and Dolnabamuk, looking at all things as our relatives, is based on this understanding of the creation of the universe, where we were all part of one seed of life. We're all comprised of this one collective of matter that is spread across the universe. In 1992 in Geneva, scientists, there should be an X on the floor.
Yeah,
I'm always on the edge. Yeah. So in 1992 in Geneva, scientists did an experiment called the twin photon experiment. And in that experiment, they wanted to see the relationship between two photons that were once connected that are then separated, to see if there's a correlation between the two. So one was stimulated in one way to see if the other would respond. And they found out that it did. And then they wanted to see if there was a time lapse between the stimulation of one and the response in the other. and they found out that there was no time lapse, that it was instantaneous, that when one was stimulated, the other instantaneously responded. And so what they devised from this was the term quantum entanglement, right? And so this quantum physics term of quantum entanglement is tied to the indigenous understanding of the web of life, that we are not just connected in theoretical ways. It's not just when I have too much, you have too little. There's a real spiritual and energetic connection that takes place. And so a way to understand that is to think about phantom limb theory. Somebody has their leg amputated and they still get sensations in their foot. Their leg still itches, they can feel it. This is another scientific understanding of Web of Life teachings from the indigenous perspective. And so that understanding is based in these concepts of quantum entanglement that says that any matter that is once connected physically can never be disconnected energetically. For us, we take that a step further and say energetically and spiritually. So because we came from this one seed of life, we can never be disconnected energetically or spiritually from one another. And so when we see this mother whale carrying her baby around for 17 days, trying to communicate to us what we're doing to life, that's a message for us about quantum entanglement. When we look around the world and we recognize that anxiety and depression is impacting the majority of the population, that's a message to us about our connectivity. The problem is that we have lost sight of the depth of our connectivity. The problem is that we don't understand that these Web of Life teachings are trying to explain to us these concepts of quantum entanglement. So when we're feeling extreme anxiety in our bodies and we can't identify the source, when we're feeling triggered by trauma, by depression, and there's no easy way for us to explain it, right? For some of us, we can easily connect our experience to our lived trauma. But what about those who had a childhood that was full of noodle salads and happy birthdays? What about those people who can't explain their trauma and connect it to their lived experience, but they're feeling it in their bodies anyway? A society tells them there's something wrong with you. You're flawed. You're broken. The truth is that something is right with them. Because what they're feeling in their bodies is the pain of that mother whale. What they're feeling in their bodies that they can't identify is the pain of the mother whose child washed up on the shore dead. That was all over the news from Syria. What they're feeling in their bodies is the immense loneliness of the last of a species who's about to go extinct. What they're feeling in their bodies is the deep grief of our tree families as their relatives are being cut down. And it's this disconnection that we have with life that causes us to respond in these frantic ways to try to fill the emptiness that we're feeling with more stuff, rather than reconnecting ourselves to life. So what I was taught was that we as women are the creators of life, that we have a sacred responsibility that was gifted to us to bring life into this world from the other side, that our bodies actually contain a portal that connects this world with the other worlds, that we call forth that life, we bring it into our bodies, and we cultivate it in the waters of life below the space where our heartbeat can be heard. And in that heart-based space, we care for and we nourish the life that we've been given. That's our first ecosystem, is our mother's womb. Then we are born a second time into this world, and that umbilical connection that has sustained us through our gestation is transferred to the Earth Mother, and the Earth Mother sustains us for the remainder of our lives. And when we lose that connection to the Earth Mother, we lose our way. And so now we're dealing with millennia of that connection being purposely severed. We're dealing with millennia of the heart-based wisdom of the sacred feminine being denied. We're dealing with the implications of millennia of masculine action out into the world not being informed by the sacred voice of Kichinuisk, who is the keeper of life. And as a result, we're creating a reality that is void of life. So we think about the things that we value in the society, and we value our role as consumers. We value youth. We value beauty, which means that we're not looking to our elders anymore, right? We're not looking to our elders for answers. We're not valuing the wisdom and the gift of old age. We're not valuing ourselves as intact human beings outside of a market valuation system. We're commodifying all aspects of who we are. And so we're seeing the evidence of that playing out on a global stage right now. And so what we call this time right now is the time of Giwalk. Giwalk is the cannibal giant. And Giwalk is the protector of the sacred feminine. Giwalk is the protector of Mother Earth. And so the story says that Giwalk lies asleep in the forest for ages, and only awakens when he hears a specific cry of the Earth Mother that tells him that human beings are consuming faster than she can produce and harming her faster than she can heal. And when Giwalk awakens, he dances the people into this frenzied illusion of mass consumption, until the species dances themselves off the planet so that the Earth Mother can renew herself. And in our stories, we're told that this is the fourth time we've been here, and we haven't figured it out yet. And so now we're here with another chance to change our course. But the only way for us to put Giwalk back to sleep is for us to wake up. And to realize that the lie that we have been fed, the original sin, in my opinion, this illusion of separation, is going to lead us to our extinction. We have to start recognizing that this belief in othering, not only within our species, the ways that we other ourselves and the ways that we separate ourselves, but also this othering from the natural world. So one of our other creation stories tells us that we were born, or we entered this world when Gluskabe, the man from nothing, that void of potential, shot an arrow into the ash tree and split it open, and we came from its roots. We emerged from within its roots. And that doesn't tell us that the ash tree is our mother. That tells us that the ash tree is our kin, that we're made up of the same foundational elements as that ash tree. And today we still weave our baskets from the ash tree to remind us that we are woven together with all of the elements of life, and that the container that holds our life is the very elements of creation that we're tied to. And so when we forget those stories, when we forget the truth of what we know deep in our core about our relationship to life, we begin acting in a way that creates an imbalance that leads to the destruction of life. And so I wanted to talk about the realigning of life because we're talking about creating this new way of being in the world that to us is ancient. We call it Skijinawe Bamausawagan. It's a way of being in relation with life that is harmoniously balanced. It's not an inherent right. It's a balancing of our rights with responsibilities. So the Earth Mother, our what we call our first Lagudawagan, right? You can call it a treaty or a contract or an agreement. This Lagudawagan is entering into a kinship relationship. And our first Lagudawagan was with Mother Earth when we came here. First with the Creator that we would come here, then with Mother Earth when we came here. And what we agreed to was to stand in protection of all life so that we would have the right to be able to freely accept the gifts that Mother Earth gave us to sustain our lives. So we believe in a balancing, right? I also come from a trade culture. You know, we traded goods. The difference is that nothing that was required for the sustaining of life was ever made a commodity. Our bodies are not commodities. Mother Earth is not a commodity. Our food, our water, our air, none of those things are commodities that you can't commodify and you can't sell and you can't create any type of legitimate balanced trade where life is at stake. And so when we're talking about a mothering economy, when we're talking about a gifting economy, we're talking about being able to sustain the very elements of life. That means changing our entire valuation system from one that's based on profitability to one that's has life at the very top. The sacredness of life, the value of life. And so I wanted to share those stories with you just to ground our time together in a bit of history that science is now beginning to understand as being more than mythology, that there's deep wisdom in our ways of being. And we understand that our oral traditions are based on Kachiniwesk speaking into Ekchimundo and creating form. We understand that frequency and vibration create form, and that that form eventually creates the reality that we're living in. There's deep scientific truth in that. It's not a mythology. And so all of these things that we're talking about are rooted in deep truth. It's not some harebrained idea that somebody just came up with. It's a balanced way of being that is aligned with life. And so there's this incredible beauty in it. And I also want to speak to you. And one of the things that we found in our community is that the pride that you're talking about is found in what we call our mother tongue. Because our language contains all of the instructive and relational elements that guide our lives. Our languages have been existing in relationship with the places where we're from for tens of thousands of years. And so as we've begun to reclaim our languages and decolonize our languages from the flat, efficient manner that they've been pared down to restore and breathe the life back into our languages, that as we're teaching our children those languages, they're learning to understand the depth of knowledge that we possess as Indigenous peoples. One of my friends tells a story about being a student, and most of the students from her community only spoke in their language, and the teachers shamed them because of the language barrier that existed between them and their English-speaking teachers. And that there was all of this feeling of inadequacy that was created in them. And when she was 19 years old, she went to her first ceremony. And when she went to that first ceremony and started to learn from those elders, she realized that everything that she really needed to know was contained within that language. She realized that her people had a complex understanding of deep science and mathematics, geology, astronomy, that there was all of this incredible depth of knowledge that she had been forcibly separated from through the intrusion of colonial education, and that reclaiming that indigenous education through the mother tongue, there's a reason why it's called the mother tongue, because it connects us in relationship to the places where we're from, that created within our young people the pride in knowing who they are and where they come from, the pride in understanding what they carry. Because one of the dangers is this kind of new age notion in oneness, because we believe that oneness equals sameness, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Because when we homogenize ourselves, we strip away our core values, and then we forget how to live in relationship to life. So when we start thinking about the fact that our ecosystems with Mother Earth, our relationship to those, give us all the information that we need in order to live healthy, whole lives, we start understanding that our human family also needs to have that same diversity. My friends in Maori territory have Maori school, right? I have friends who have Greek school. Reminding of those core values and insistence upon knowing those core values. We have immersion schools in our territory. We're going to be creating a Wabanaki school, which is an after-school program that teaches all of these things to our children. Right? There's all of these different cultural teachings that are taught in an extracurricular form of environment, where the parents are taking responsibility for ensuring that the core values remain intact. And I think that's how we create pride, is by really making a point of ensuring that the core values of where you come from, the core values of your people, are instilled within the hearts of your children. And we do that by demonstrating that pride ourselves. Right? We have to show them how to get there. By showing them that we're on that path as well. You know, it's not just something that somebody else can give them. It has to rise up from within them, and we give that to them. So I think I'm just going to say that much for now. There's a lot more I could share with you, but there's a lot of other people that want to speak, and I want to honor their time. So I just will say to you, Kachi Williwan, thank you so much for having me, and Pasilda Andil Nabamuk. You know, I offer these words for all my relations. And there's one more thing that I wanted to say that I should have said at the beginning, and I ask that the ancestors of this land forgive me, but I want to recognize that we're standing on the original land of the indigenous peoples of this place. And so one of my favorite quotes is from a Crow elder named Shis Crow that says, "The soil you see beneath your feet is not ordinary soil. It is the dust of the bones, the flesh, and the blood of my ancestors. The soil as it is my dead and my blood." And that's another thing that we need to remember, is that the ancestors of those who have lived in relationship with that land have more than a territorial relationship. They have a blood relationship with that place. And so I just want to honor the original peoples of this place, Mississaugas, Haudenosaunee, Ojibwe, Wendat, Cree. There's a whole lot of indigenous peoples that came from this territory. And so I want to recognize and I want to honor them. And I ask you to do the same. Thank you.
Sherry Mitchell, author of the book Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change. She spoke in Toronto on April 15th, 2019. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or download from our website, wingsradio.org. Thank you to your local community radio stations, to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we're creeping up on the noon o'clock hour, which means we're going to shift into some music. My good friend Nick Geffro is here to bring you, 2 hours of living jazz, the jazz that lives, if I recall correctly. And then there's more jazz at 2 to 4, and we're going to shift you back into some important information that you need in order to be a fully rounded, you'll already be a well-entertained citizen, participant in your community. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
And now, the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, June 26th, 2019. In local news, the cap-and-trade bill that caused Republican senators to flee the state is dead, Senate President Peter Courtney, a Democrat, announced Tuesday. Courtney urged the Republican senators to return to Salem, as there are a wide array of policy and budget bills that have yet to be passed this session. The cap-and-trade policy would cap carbon emissions and would make polluters pay for the greenhouse gas production, was a Democratic priority this past session. Supporters of the bill stood and turned their back on Courtney during the announcement. In national news, a harrowing photograph of a migrant father and daughter that drowned while attempting to cross the border from Mexico to the United States shows the horrors of the crisis at the border. For months, advocates have been warning that the deaths at the border would increase as migrants are now being forced to try and cross more dangerous areas as a result of U.S. authorities making it harder for those seeking asylum to turn themselves in at ports of entry. The mother of the drowned Salvadorian man urged her son to, quote, not follow the American dream. In more national news, House Democrats have approved $4.5 billion in humanitarian aid for the southern border crisis in the wake of migrant deaths and the reports of severe neglect of children in migrant camps. The bill now faces a difficult path through the Republican-controlled Senate. The White House says President Trump would be advised to veto the House bill if it landed on his desk. In international news, thousands of protesters in Hong Kong marched to major foreign consulates today, urging G20 leaders to help liberate the city. Millions have protested in recent weeks against an extradition bill that would have allowed individuals to be extradited to mainland.